Donald Trump has been called many things by friends and foe, but Trump, peace president, an intriguing thought. And to make the case, we're joined by LNL's regular conservative commentator, Daniel McCarthy, columnist for The Spectator USA and editor of Modern Age, a conservative review. Daniel, welcome back. But before we tackle the idea of Trump getting the Nobel Peace Prize, I must say that the Cohen performance today adds further to the wider world's absolute distaste for the president and his regime. How did you respond to it?
Well, it was sleazy and sensational, but I don't know that it has really changed things from a legal dimension. Cohen has, you know, many allegations that he's made, some of which have, you know, support of various kinds, but actually don't seem to be, you know, of a kind of ironclad, you know, legal peril for the president. So he says the president has, you know, was engaged in negotiations for this Trump Tower in Moscow throughout much of the election season. He says that, you know, the president's financial dealings may be examined by prosecutors in the Southern District of New York. And then he has this check, which Donald Trump gave him as a return for the payments that Cohen made to Stormy Daniels. All of that is, again, quite sleazy, but very little of that is actually of a sort that would be legally perilous to the president, barring, you know, whatever we don't know about, you know, financial fraud that the Southern District might be.
Daniel, on a personal level, does it not disgust you?
None of it shocks me, and none of it is surprising. So in that sense, it's difficult to be rattled by, you know, circumstances that one has been aware of for some time. And then Cohen himself, I think, is a very unappealing character, and whether what he's saying is actually true is something we will yet discover.
Now, many of us at the time thought that Barack Obama getting a Nobel Peace Prize was to say the least, faintly absurd, but to hear that the Donald is being or has been nominated by his by the president or the prime minister of Japan came as a great shock.
It certainly has. And yet, you know, Donald Trump is someone who, rather than pursuing the kind of regime change operations that we saw both under George W. Bush and eventually with Barack Obama as well, is someone who has, you know, a very wide openness toward meeting with people like Kim Jong-un and attempting to resolve conflicts peacefully. So Donald Trump, to a surprising degree, is a shift, or a continuing shift, really, in American foreign policy. I think, you know, Barack Obama was a start, and in some ways, even though Trump himself would probably be the last person to say this, but in some ways, I think Trump is continuing the move away from militarism that you saw with Obama.
Meanwhile, in Vietnam, a summit meeting which verges on the as almost a fiasco. How do you understand that?
Well, you know, Trump says in this book that has his name on it, The Art of the Deal, that a negotiator always has to be willing to walk away from a table if the deal is not correct. It's been interesting to see or hear Donald Trump's response to the collapse of the talks. He says, you know, the discussions will continue. They're not going to have a signing ceremony today. They, you know, are very far apart from the North Koreans when it comes to what denuclearization will actually mean. But, you know, discussions are ongoing. You know, the North Koreans wanted the more or less complete dropping of sanctions. The Trump administration wasn't prepared to go that far. But, you know, it does seem as if the North Koreans were prepared to, you know, dismantle the Yongbyon nuclear enrichment facility. That seems like progress. And it seems also that the fact that North Koreans haven't been continuing to sort of flagrantly test weapons has also been a sign of progress.
Our other voice from America, Bruce Shapiro, was making the point on Monday and on Tuesday that it's much better to talk than to, what did Winston Churchill say? Jaw is better than war. So I suppose at least Trump is talking.
He's talking, and he has, I think, you know, the criticisms of Trump in the run-up to the now aborted summit. The criticisms were that Donald Trump was going to give away the candy store. He was basically going to go very easy on Kim and come up with a very lax deal that would fail to, you know, really hold the North Koreans to any standards, and that would nevertheless, you know, very much ease up on sanctions. That didn't happen. Donald Trump, you know, and Kim were both willing to, you know, sort of call off these talks, or at least call off this meeting. But nevertheless, it seems as if, you know, there's this Donald Trump didn't come out today and say, well, this means we're going back to a war footing. This means we're going back to, you know, a state of escalation. Far from it. Donald Trump set expectations in a kind of interesting way beforehand by saying this process might be slow. And he was correct. You know, obviously, it's going even slower than he might have anticipated. Nevertheless, you know, patience is what's called for here.
I'm old enough to remember the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower. He was a man who knew all about war, and yet he was very, very careful not to mire the U.S. in another. You draw parallels between Eisenhower and Trump.
I think both of them have a, you know, sort of reality-based and more or less transactional view of U.S. foreign policy, as opposed to the more ideological and idealistic view, which a variety of figures, both in the Republican Party and the Democratic Party, have had since then. So as different as Donald Trump and Dwight Eisenhower most certainly are, nevertheless, both of them are non-ideologues, and I think that is perhaps the most important characteristic of both of them.
Talking to Daniel McCarthy, and let me quote your recent piece for American Conservative. Trump knows that the foreign policy establishment is bankrupt, and that's what makes him a president who can actually give peace a chance. Please explain.
Well, the foreign policy establishment is not very creative in its thinking, and it has a certain number of enemies that it has designated over the long run, various rogue states, or what George W. Bush called the Axis of Evil, as well as various you know, international actors of other kinds of maleficence. And the foreign policy establishment, you know, is often of the view that the U.S. can just give a, you know, a hard line to all of these you know, movements and countries, and that when push comes to shove, the U.S. will shove hardest and will simply intervene and resolve any problem by brute force. And we've seen that, you know, from the Middle East to the Balkans to a variety of other places. And Donald Trump, he so far seems to see intervention as being something the American people are not willing to support in the long run. And therefore, he's been extremely reluctant to go in with the kind of force and scope of other presidents. Now, that's not to say that we've pulled back from the Middle East or from Africa or from any number of other places where special operations are ongoing and there's actually quite a lot of sort of low-intensity engagement. But we haven't seen the kind of nation-building program that you had with other recent presidents.
And I must say, in recent times, Trump's been criticized for retreating from war zones rather than igniting new ones.
Well, that's the ironic thing, is that you know, there seems to have been a sort of switching of positions here, where Republicans who might be expected to be rather hawkish are, in fact, you know, supportive of Donald Trump as president and his diplomatic initiatives. Whereas Democrats, who might be expected to be the party of, you know, ancestrally the party of George McGovern, you know, who was considered something of a peacenik in 1972, the Democrats today are, in fact, you know, in some respects quite hawkish and are alarmed by the idea that the president is meeting with or was going to meet with Kim Jong-un. And they're alarmed by the fact that, you know, we might not be at a kind of, you know, new Cold War footing with Russia. So it'll be interesting to see how American politics evolves.
I'm sure the Pentagon is not a monolithic organization, but one wonders if there's a prevailing view amongst the generals about Trump.
That's a very good question. By the time people get to the rank of general, they are as much political entities as they are military ones. It'd be very interesting to know of what the junior officer corps thinks of Donald Trump. And in some ways, they are, you know, I think the more sort of representative of the military's own point of view. The military in general does seem to be weary of the kind of policing activities that it's been assigned throughout the world. I think the higher up the ranks you go, the more appetite you do find, however, for remaining in Afghanistan and generally sticking with what the political establishment so far has insisted upon. But I think further down the ranks, you know, with the junior officers and then with the enlisted men, you actually find a great weariness of operations that are generally not not the kind of winning that you know, most military people have in mind by the idea of victory.
A final question: did Trump really oppose the invasion of Iraq?
So shortly after, at the very outset of the invasion, he seemed to support it and seemed to say so on the radio. But within a few weeks, he was an opponent of it, and that's significant because you know, a few weeks or you know, a month or two into this invasion, the Iraq War in 2003 was still very popular. So Donald Trump was ahead of the curve. And actually did, you know, perhaps take some risks by opposing it when he did, even though at the very outset he may have been supporting it, or at least there's one radio interview where he seems to suggest that.
And we must remember that Hillary was on that issue a hawk. Daniel, thank you. Daniel McCarthy, columnist for The Spectator USA, and editor of Modern Age, the Conservative Review.